So I had a few months to think about it and just realized, why not? I keep saying I want to do something more meaningful. If I don't try now, I'll never do it.
Hello and welcome to the Gross Profit Podcast. My name is James Kennedy. I am the CEO and co-founder at ProcurementExpress.com. We take the hassle out of managing your spend without buying an ERP, but we are not here to talk about that today. Instead, I've got Vincent Biscay from Two Step Advisors, a man who probably had one of the most lucrative careers on the planet and walked it away from it all to help lowly entrepreneurs realize their dreams. And we're going to hear all about that today in the world of what they call in the US, CPG, or more particularly drinks, consumer packaged goods. If you're in the UK, you might call it FMCG. I don't know why we have so many acronyms, but we do. Let's get going. Vincent, tell us something about you that not many people know.
I think the thing that surprised my friends the most, and that I don't talk about in the industry much, is that while I'm a French citizen, which you might get from the accent, I arrived in France when I was 16 years old. So I was born there, but then I had the chance to move through my parents' work from age 3 months to 16 years, living in countries such as Spain, South Korea, the Netherlands, and Norway. So I think that is a pretty unusual start as a kid to a teenager, up to a teenager, in terms of adaptability, language, change in general.
I wonder about this. My wife is South African, and you know, we lived part of our life in South Africa with the kids, and then we moved the kids up here. How does it like impact you? Do you feel Spanish, French, Norwegian, South Korean? Like, how does it affect your identity when you're not really, you know, belonging anywhere, but belonging everywhere at the same time?
Yeah, no, I think I definitely feel French. That was something throughout, because I was able to go to the French schools in these countries. But I've always felt international, meaning very open to different cultures, different languages. I'm decently good at speaking languages or learning languages. So these are things, obviously, that I'm grateful for, because I was just in it. But I think it's just being very open, outgoing, that definitely came into my personality because of the travels and the changes. That was not only great things about moving every 3 to 4 years as a kid. Obviously, you have attachment issues or things like that. You don't make friends. So I don't have childhood friends, for example, which is for some other people is like mind-blowing. Some people have at least two friends from kindergarten. For me, my best friends, I made them when I met them, and they're still my best friends from usually about 18, 19 years old till today.
Yeah. Very good. So is there anything, you know, all that change and all those languages, I guess, that you gives you any sort of edge as a CFO?
I think for sure it's the approachability and being able to get along, whether it's with the clients or with team members. You know, I run a company. Initially, I was a CFO. I went in the second part of my career, which I'm sure we're going to talk about, as the founder of Step 2. I was just by myself. I started by myself. So I was indeed a CFO, but for the CFO skill set, that experience didn't necessarily help. It's more about the business development, maintaining good relationships with clients, getting along, all these things. And then as I build a team, it was even more important, keeping everyone, keep creating a company culture, just being a good listener, all these things that I think are important to be a leader and build a business, basically.
And in a way, counterintuitive to what the stereotype of what a finance person is, right? You think it's talk behind a spreadsheet somewhere, not wanting to talk to anyone, when in fact, the best who reach the top are much more closer to diplomats, I always think. Maybe that's your international flair coming through there. I feel like it's quite a diplomatic role.
Yes, it's 100% true. The roles that we have, controllers, bookkeepers, in general, we are not the most chatty. We just love being in our numbers, in our models, in our systems. And it's still true today. I think if most of the people in the finance field are like that. I'm just lucky that I have this other skill set that developed early, which helps me, I think, do what I'm doing beyond just the work. It's, like I said, building a company, for example. Otherwise, I probably would have stayed an independent consultant, maybe, or not that grit or desire to be surrounded by other people and build something like that.
So you didn't start off on a path towards being a CFO. How did you start off and how did you end up here?
I mean, yeah, it's completely different what I started doing. I went to some decent schools in France. I had a very academic upbringing in general, but then I was pretty good in science and math. And so it was really, I had a trajectory towards engineering, things of that nature. Finance was not on the radar. And then I did an engineering school. And then I wasn't sure what I wanted to do even after that. Usually you build bridges, planes, things like that. A lot of my friends from college did that, but I didn't get a fit from that. So I graduated and then I went on to continue my studies and did a master's in finance. At that point, my father he's retired now, was a banker and he was on the investment banking side. And so I knew that sector well, and I didn't want to do the exactly same thing as he did. I think there's always this strange relationship with you. You want to impress your parents, but you don't necessarily want to do exactly the same thing. So the other part of banking that I did know about that was also something that could have been interesting to me at the time was the capital markets. And so by doing this master's in finance, I was hoping to learn about this more and obviously like it and then go into that field. And that's what happened. And so I became a trader, a junior trader, and someone who brings the coffee to the senior traders really at the beginning, but thankfully built a career quite successfully, in particular in the commodity market. So I was, I think, lucky to get a spot in a seat that's not easy to find because there's not a lot of commodity traders in the world. And and I learned from an experienced trader step by step until I became the head of the department myself. And it was about a 10-year journey. That could have been 40 years, but that was a twist.
Yeah. So a lot of bankers I know, there's either two types. There's the lifers, like you say, who are going to have the country club membership and, you know, maybe a couple of private flying miles and, you know, they're on that track and they're very happy with it. And then there's the other ones who are always got a side hustle, they're just doing it, gritting their teeth and getting through it until they can launch their side hustle. So it seems like even though it was all laid out for you, and I'm sure you were set for life, sounds like being head of a department in a trading firm is a lucrative place to be. You said that was a bit too easy for you. What caught your eye?
Yeah, I don't want to, at the time, it's not really necessarily the words that were going through my head that it was too easy. It was comfortable. Right. But I did have not an existential crisis or anything like that. I was just not doing anything that added value. You know, you're in front of 9 screens at the time. I had 9 screens and just playing with my mouse and buying and selling and building strategies and making money for the bank. That's the job. And if you're good at the job, you enjoy it. And it's, like I said, comfortable. But then I had other friends that were developing entrepreneurship careers. Mm-hmm. So I'm 45 this summer and I was a trader from the age of 25 to 34, okay, give or take. So just about 10 years. And when I was about 30, in the middle of that time, my other friends in their 30s, some of them were already switching careers into entrepreneurship. Mm. And they were starting to do things that were really meaningful. And they were a lot more interesting than I was at dinners and passion and conversations and things. And I had nothing to say. I would talk about sports. Nobody would care about the commodity markets, obviously. Yeah. It's interesting. You know, everybody works 9, 10, 12 hours a day, sometimes more. It's the most time you spend is at work. And if you can't take any of this into your personal life or conversation, et cetera, it doesn't add anything. I started to feel a gap with my friends and a void, and I wanted to perhaps do something else, but I didn't think about it more. It's actually some friends that reached out to me for an opportunity in the food and beverage space.
Okay, I'm going to ask about that. But I'm curious, is there anything, do you think, from that period of being a trader that taught you something that now you use in your finance career, you know, advising startups?
Well, I think a lot. I think, well, first of all, the discipline. There's no room for error when you're a trader and you have to set up processes. You have to be strict with the things you do. And I think that might sound a little broad what I'm saying, but it's very important. So, you know, you start something. So when we build a model, the way we build models for emerging brands, it's every week we're not going in all sorts of places. There's a process and silos every week with thematics. And that's something that comes from being a trader for sure. And I think naturally being good with numbers, the more being sharp, that when you're a trader, you are the sharpest person on the planet. You cannot miss a beat. And I think resilience, like a trader's work is short in a sense because it's the hours of the market, but you do not blink during I don't know how many hours straight. As a matter of fact, I would barely move from my seat, whether it's to go to the restroom or to have lunch. You just stay focused. And so now my life is not that extreme, but I'm able to have a very long time where I work and focus on something that needs to get done. And that comes very naturally.
And are you, when you're sitting there in front of the screens, do you have to sort of know, hey, if this company, whatever, I guess commodities, I don't know, like if this price goes above a certain amount, I know that I'm going to do this and this and I have to watch for it, or you have to be aware of it all, ready to jump into action. But yes, at the same time, you're saying you've learned to discipline, like you can't be doing that. You can't be hopping all around the place. How do you avoid that? Do you write it out beforehand and say, okay, this is what I'm going to do and I'm not going to do anything else? Or how do you enforce that discipline internally even? How do you
This is a great question, because there are definitely two types of things happening as a trader. There are the things that are from the discipline, meaning you know when to stop a position, for example. So if you're starting to lose money, the discipline is, if I lose X, I'm out. And there's no, maybe, look, something's going to happen. No, there's no, you've already decided how much you're going to lose. And the same thing for how much you're going to win. Mm-hmm. So there is no room for greediness and no room for, to gamble. And I hope I can make this back by keeping the position. It's going to bounce back. It's going to bounce back. No. So that discipline, it's things that you write on paper, you set them up when you have positions on. But there is a part which is the gut feeling, the experience, where the market is going. Is this an anomaly? The tariffs. We've all seen the impact of a tweet and a comment from the White House on tariffs, very unusual, unexpected, and drastic measures that would come to place in 30 days, etc. The markets had faster than they had since 2008 or something like that. In those situations, the traders will make decisions on the spot, and there was nothing that could plan for that. And so you do have to be able to follow your gut. Sometimes you break those rules of the processes in that particular scenario. So it's a mix of that, day trading and discipline around it.
Art and science. Okay, cool. Sounds juxtaposed there. But I guess that's business for you, right? So you had a few friends who gave you a chance. I don't believe you were kind of working part-time. You mentioned that you're a trader, but when you're off. So that gave you a bit of opportunity to get your first taste of entrepreneurship. What was that?
Yeah, this was really, the details are that I decided to explore another opportunity. I wanted to explore other opportunities in the trading world. So you can be a trader in a bank. In the case of commodities, you can be a trader in a commodity house. Think BP, Shell, and there's plenty of others. And you can also be a trader in a hedge fund. And so these last two were things I had not explored. And so I wanted to give myself a little bit of time to think about maybe that development in my career. Mm. And so I actually quit my job and went on not a sabbatical, but gave myself some vacation. I gave myself 3 to 6 months to travel the world a little bit. I was single. I was 33, 34. And so
sounds great,
right? And it was great. And I'm starting applying softly to maybe these other categories. And while that was happening, I had a friend who knew that I was available or maybe more open-minded. And he had started a beverage brand in the US, in New York, with his cousin and his cousin's girlfriend. And they were making what at the time was not developed anywhere in the world, except there was one brand in the US. It was cold press juices. And so it was the idea of pressing the fruits and vegetables, creating blends of good juices, but not heating them or pasteurizing them. Because when you drink a Tropicana, it's probably stripped out of all vitamins because it's been heated. And it's the case for most beverages that are shelf stable. So if they're not refrigerated, first of all, it's probably a sign that the ones in Tetra Pak, etc., what good can there be in there? And the ones refrigerated are sometimes still pasteurized, but they trick you by putting them in the fridge so you think they're fresh. But then the cold press juice era started, I think, in the late 2000, with a company called Blueprint in the US. And then a couple of other people started doing it, and then it became something worldwide mainstream. But long story short, they asked me if I could help them or if I was interested in perhaps being a fourth partner or co-founder, because they felt that they lacked the business part, business and the finance acumen. They were very good in operations, very good in creative, very good in manufacturing and R&D. And I said, no, of course not.
Because you're sensible. I mean, basically, they had a lemonade stand. That's what they're saying. They were like, hey, come on, come on. Now, far from it being a lemonade stand, this business is actually mind-blowingly financially challenging to get through all the different hoops you need. There's a development phase through to, I guess, you know, the sort of thing, distribution. And then there's a whole myriad of, and never mind on that, you know, production issues. And then on top of that, you had something that was fresh, so needed a cold chain, I'm guessing, which makes an extra whole other complication. Yep. So tell us, okay, you turned them down, but I guess you helped them a little bit. But like, what stage were they at when you came to them? Had they already got distribution? Had they built a brand? Or what phase in the development were they?
Yeah, I mean, I turned them down the first time when we were grabbing a drink. And then they asked me again a month later. And then they asked me again, I think, the third or the fourth month of my trips. And yeah. And at that point, I actually said, okay, I'm going to look at this. So I had a few months to think about it and just realized, why not? I keep saying I want to do something more meaningful. If I don't try now, I'll never do it. And if I fail, I'll just apply for a job in those trading fields that I just described earlier. So eventually, their persistence, which is a very important quality of an entrepreneur, made me say yes. And so no, I did not help them on the side. I just went all in, I think it was about 6 months after I had left the trading job. And so here I was just trying to help anywhere I could. And to answer your question about where they were, about almost 2 years in, they had started in glass bottles, self-delivering in their car. Those stories that you like to read about founders' journeys. And then by the time they started this business, so in 2012, in glass bottles, delivered to the door. You have 3 days to drink it. Then you go pick up the glass again, you clean it, and you do it again. By that time, the technology called HPP, high pressure processing, had gone to market in a very limited capacity. Now it's obviously very large worldwide. And what HPP does is it puts pressure on the packaging that contains anything fresh, and the high pressure, cold water pressure basically eliminates some of the bacteria that causes fresh products or juices to go bad after 3 days. And so it's extending the shelf life without heating. And initially the extension was 10 days, then 20 days. And then with a little bit more juices, lemon juice, a bit more acidity, et cetera, now you can get up to 60 days, even more sometimes, with something that has not been heated. And it's applied to avocado puree or other fruit purees. Now there's a much more a wider utilization. And then all cold pressed juices and smoothies and soups and protein shakes that are not heated can be cold pressed and HPP'd and stay on the shelves for about 60 days. So they discovered that, started testing it. And unfortunately, you have to use plastic bottles for that because glass would not allow the pressure to hit the liquid. And so that's roughly when I joined, and they were doing a few hundred thousand in revenue already. So there was traction, and so I was not starting from nothing, but there was still a lot of things to do.
Yeah, interesting. So that expression, being early, is same as being wrong. They were just at this right time. Maybe this business would never have scaled if that technology had not come along at that particular time. And this new technology, was this something that they sort of had to engineer themselves, or was it like an engineering company they could build, they had to buy equipment for it? Or was
The first HPP machines were about $1 million each. And so That was completely out of reach. But because the technology was coming to market, some people would actually, two or three companies around New York had made a business out of that, bought the machines and started leasing them or charging per run or per batch of HPP. And so these were very lucrative businesses, are lucrative businesses today, but at the time it was very capital intensive and took a while to get different brands to bring their business there. But it's always been outsourced for us.
Yeah, so straight away, this is a new financial component here. Like you have to finance even a quarter of $1 million machine is still quite an overhead you have to put into something you're selling for $5 or $8, I guess.
We had machines because we self-manufactured the juices. And initially, you would use a blender. the initial time, it was a professional blender that you would have in a juice bar, but still a blender. So very time consuming and labor intensive. But then as we got serious about this, there are stainless steel machines that cold press juices and vegetables and fruits, but with much larger scale and a rotary systems, etc. So we invested into those. And obviously, like you said, that the finance component started to kick in. But it started to kick in also immediately with pricing strategy, distributors, margins. I already was in it trying to figure out, are we going to make any money selling these things? So, yeah.
Well, there seems like six different ways from Sunday you could murder yourself in this business. So did they, they said there was revenue. Were they making any money, or was it, had they an idea that they would ever be able to make money before? Was it clear? Like, was there a clear path that, okay, we're losing money now, but eventually we'll be able to afford one of these machines and then it'll all come together? Or was it vaguer than that?
No, it was very vague. And I think it's the case for a lot of brands in different categories. Just entrepreneurs, they look at the economics at the with a kind of a high level view, back of the napkin, and then they hope it works. Yeah, we're starting there. We must probably get better in cost of goods in the future. But you need to do a little bit of a deeper analysis. We didn't, by the way. We didn't do any of the right things at the time. But just to put some examples here, we didn't pay ourselves. So while maybe we were profitable or we didn't feel like we were needed to put more business, more money in the business, if you take three or four payrolls out, it's easier to make money. Yeah. We would do direct sale because we didn't have a distributor. So we would cut the middleman at the beginning because of the lack of options and make the full margin on the sale. But as soon as you want to grow, you have to give this to someone else, put that in their truck, and they're going to charge you or upcharge about 20%. And so you have to give them 20% less so that they can sell it at the same price to the retailer. So suddenly you just lost 20% of margin to scale. And so you have to get that back with high volume, which you don't have right away. And so the chicken and the egg is called working capital. And so you're growing, but the more you grow and the more you're using third parties, the more cash you need to get you to the point where you make that money back. So all of that was learning by doing. And my background didn't seem to help forecast these things, but it helped solve problems, solving on the spot, trying to figure out when there's a fire, we're able to solve it fast. But I wish we could have, I would have had more experience back then, but that's how you make experience, I suppose.
Well, you know, it's the cliche. If you knew how hard it was going to be, you never would have started. So that's you can't overthink these things. Yeah.
I would have stayed in my in front of my ninth screen. Yes.
Can you think of a time when your finance skills put out a fire that sort of you were able to solve a problem that was somehow seemed urgent in the business?
Yeah, I think that happened daily and still happens today with the dozen clients we have. It's really, it is being an entrepreneur, even with a $10 or $20 million company. It's, I think the job is to constantly put out fires constantly. When I was at the beverage company, the type of fires we had were, from a finance standpoint, were basically a new client, a new customer opportunity. We're super excited. We talk, we sample, they say, yes, we're interested. And so only at the end, they tell you roughly how much they want to buy it for, or you offer your price and they say it's too expensive. And so you've done all this work. And now what happens? All my partners say, we have to do it. We have to do it. We need this new customer. Mm-hmm. And so it's not really a fire, but it's a constant decision making where I say, sorry, we can't do it. The price doesn't work. Yeah, we'll figure it out later. We have to grow. We need those customers. So this back and forth, push and pull was very frequent. And sometimes the majority wins. And then I have to figure out ways that to quickly get money out of that. And sometimes we said no to the client, definitely rarely. And that is still the case for a lot of entrepreneurs out there. The power of saying no is one of the most...
Super hard. And the finance team is a tricky one. They're often ones that sort of wants to bring a reality check to what's going on. And that's the maybe the diplomatic part of it, right? How do you deliver that news all the time? Normally that news is never go spend more money. It's normally the other way around.
Yes, we don't have a great role in general.
Well, yeah, this is the thing. I think the ones who can have managed to communicate that well have an amazing skill. That's why it's so difficult and undervalued. So you raised a little bit of money for this. So maybe tell me a little bit generally, like in a SaaS business these days, wow, people are doing seed rounds at like 5 million. And that's, or an AI business might do even 10 or 20 million seed round, and then it goes on and so forth. What's the general trajectory in terms of fundraising and stages beyond, okay, you've got your first couple of 100,000, but you need to scale, you need capital. what's the generalized path forward for a business like this?
Yeah, so it starts exactly like you described. For the entrepreneurs that can, it's important to gather a little bit of money, whether it's yours, some friends, some family, and if you're lucky, someone who might be an angel investor very early. But you do need $100,000 to get a brand off the ground, branding, first runs, some R&D, some things like that. So that is important. Once you've done that, and hopefully you have some of that money, or most of that money goes into inventory, then you start selling it, and then you start seeing, does it have legs? So that's what happened to us, obviously. I think the initial capital was about $100,000, and that lasted for a long time because we didn't pay ourselves. We were very lean. So that lasted for at least a year and a half. And then we needed another $50,000 because there were machines that were involved to try to improve there. So it's a little different situation because we self-manufacture. But then after that, we got into a decent amount of accounts and we're like, okay, this is working. Now we need to raise money. Like, we need to raise $2 million. And so they all looked at me and like, hey, you are the person coming from finance, so go raise. Yeah. And I didn't know how to do it. So I knew that you had to put a deck, did some slides on PowerPoint that were very bad in design and in content. But, you know, I thought they would deliver the message. And then how do you find investors? It's not because you come from finance that you have a network. And so I started building a network, going to events, LinkedIn, one by one. And eventually, I think we wanted to raise, like I said, about $1.5 million. And it took us like 3 to 4 months, and we got some leads, and 300,000 was committed. And we were like, this is not enough to do all the things we want. It's far from $1.5 million, and we don't have a lot more leads, and this is like pulling teeth. So what are we doing wrong? And I think it was just a lack of expertise, network, things take more time. And so we obviously took the money, and we could only go so far with that. If we needed $1.5 million to take it to the next level for, let's say, another 18 months, we had like 20% of that. So instead of having 18 months, we had 20% of 18 months. So we ended up running out of cash again. And that was where a lot of tensions and stress and pressure started to come in. And we had to make some difficult decisions. So the reason you need money in CPG early stage is because every time you win an account or you grow, you need to support that account.
Right.
And so that I'm getting to the question you've asked is like, what are the different stages when you raise? And like I said, seed money or pre-revenue money, pre-seed, a couple hundred thousand, then things go well, you need some sort of seed money. And in the case of beverage, it's higher than everybody else because beverage is more cash intensive. So let's say a million minimum. And then after that, you get more accounts and you need to hire salespeople. You need to do more marketing. You need to do demos, very cash intensive before you even see a return on all of this. And so after a seed round, you do a Series A, but to be warranting a Series A, you need to have $3 to $5 million in sales. To get $3 to $5 million in sales, you need to have that product that's moving, and you need to have 500 doors or more. So there's a lot that go into this. And so we were right there. We were in 1,000 doors. We were doing over $1 million. We were doing about $1.5 million when we tried to raise $1.5 million. And so, and that was our seed round, but yet we didn't get the money fast enough. Let's say it took, like I said, about 3-4 months. It's not that we gave up, but the reality hits you. The 300,000 was spent because we continued to support the new account that we had. And once you run out of money, you have to slow down. Slow down means firing people. Didn't want to do that, or didn't have a lot of people to fire, to be honest. And stop the marketing, which in turn means your velocity goes down. And then the buyers and the retailers are not happy. And so you start getting discontinued. And in our case, it was very different. We said to one of our largest account, I think we should pull out because we're going to continue to inject money that is not going to be enough. And we didn't raise the money we want to raise. And we don't want this to fail in 6 months when it's going to be bad for everyone. And so we pulled out of our largest account and went from 1,000 doors to 800. And then we said, okay, what do we do? And that's where we pivoted. And the story is great because 10 years later, everything went well, but we had no choice. And the pivot was, since we can't support financially our brand in supermarkets because it's expensive to do business there, but we have machines and cold press is now a trend like this, can we make product for other people?
And do you, Yeah, go ahead.
No, and that's what happened. We started getting clients that were brands or bakeries or restaurants, and they all wanted cold pressed juices on their menus. And so that kept the lights on. And then we doubled down on that over the years. But at that point, I decided to become a passive partner and leave the boat. Because for me, the vision was not to be a co-manufacturing company. The vision was to be a brand and grow to tens of millions and sell for hundreds of millions. And so once I lost that connection, I wasn't sure I didn't know better. And so that's when I reinvented myself and created Step 2.
Very interesting. So, I mean, you mentioned on our pre-interview that, you know, you love the people in the industry. Like there's a sort of a community of people who are into or very passionate about this, not always thinking things through unless they have a finance guy on team, just ready, fire, aim type of thing. But there's also like in retail is full of sharks. It's like you're often dealing with, it's very lopsided. You're dealing with huge, big companies and tiny little suppliers oftentimes. And they have all sorts of sort of, you know, tricks, if you like, and unusual things. So what makes food and beverages accounting different to take account? What do you have to think about differently compared to a regular business?
You're spot on the way the industry works. And I'm not too familiar with Europe or Asia or other places, but the US being one of the largest markets, I can just speak for that. Yes, there are very big players at the top, big retailers and big distributors. They set the rules, they make a lot of money, and the distributors in particular have different ways to, and it's not just by distributing the product. It's by having fees and penalties if you don't follow very strict rules of delivering on time, delivering the right quantities. A botched case will look like it's a little damaged. The whole pallet will be returned plus some fees. There are a lot of things that go into working with large distributors. And then on the retail side, they want promotions and they want discounts. And so those discounts go through the distributor, and sometimes there's fees to process the discounts. And so just everything adds up. If you don't know any of this and you launch a brand, you're going to get absolutely destroyed. You're going to lose your shirt. And it happens every day today, even though we're in 2025 and this industry is decades old and everybody knows this, it still happens. And the typical example is all of our clients that get a first big account, 500 doors or more, and the distributor, and they win, and it's a big win because they also get listed in the distributor. So they're like so excited. This distributor is going to take them other places, and they get the first order, and it's $100,000 order. First, they get paid 6 months later because it's the first time they do business, and second, they might get 20K out of the 130 or something, and they expected 80. And why? It's because they gave 100 with 20% discount, they expect 80, but they forgot that there was the free fill. They had to give free product to their retailer. So the first order is free, actually, out of the 100, so a deduction for product. At what price are they getting the free product? Not at their COGS, at the listed price, the highest price that's being deducted, a price that they never even got dollars for. And then some fees, some deduction, something happened in the warehouse, something was wrong in the UPC code. And so you add these together, you didn't get the money, and you get half of it or less. And these can be avoided. They can be avoided by being prepared, being surrounded with the experts. But it's, if you're an early stage brand, you can't be surrounded by everybody because that's expensive, even at a fractional level. But thankfully, still much cheaper than hiring a team of five out of the gate, which is, you know, an operations person, sales, marketing, finance around a founder. That requires a lot of money up front and it's very rare.
So I guess this means a lot of people come into this industry, they get chewed up by the distributors, they churn out, go out of business. Distributors don't care because they've, you know, provided some innovation or whatever they're offering to do for their clients. But is there any leverage here, or do you just have to eat it and sort of cost it, you know, the cost of being the new guy on the block? Or is it possible to negotiate and watch out for these things and get ahead of them?
I think the founders that do best are the ones that have asked hundreds of people before they even started. And by people, I mean advisors, people that have done this before, consultants. You can get a lot. That's why I love this industry. Everybody's very generous with their time, gives a lot of advice. In this day and age, since COVID, with Zoom webinars, there are thousands of hours available and new content and podcasts like this one out there. So there's a lot more information. And then there's AI. AI is completely changing the game. It's a bit early, but there are companies that are basically selling relatively affordable software to take care of these problems or to challenge some of the deductions that might be inaccurate or things like that. So there are things that can happen to mitigate that potential downfall. And you'd be surprised how resilient the founders are. They might lose their shirt on the first 100,000.
Right.
They won't give up. They realize that they messed up, and then they will go out and raise a little bit more money, produce again, and not do the same mistake again and continue. But it's just that you got such a bad start because, you know, you want to avoid as much as possible these pitfalls so that you go faster and succeed versus your competition. So that's what fractional people can help achieve.
Okay, let me be brave here and try and ask a question about the income statement, because I was trying to figure out recently why our discounts were showing up in cost of goods sold on Stripe. We use Stripe, and we were trying to figure out, well, what the hell is going on? And we couldn't figure out what it was. And is that the way you should show it for these businesses? Like if they're giving discounts, is it kind of a marketing expense?
All right, we're going straight into an accounting question. You actually asked if CPG accounting was very different than others, and I answered with examples, but not the actual question. I don't know any accounting that is harder than CPG, because I just talked about the discounts and what can happen with a distributor, but cost of goods, inventory, sales and marketing that can be extremely broad, and there's a lot of things you can spend money on. All of these things, but in particular COGS, inventory, and discounts, are the most difficult things to master and understand in general. And so that's why I didn't know this going into this industry, but it's very hard to find a small brand that has good books that in turn help the founder analyze the numbers correctly. There's always something that's off. In the example of fees in COGS, so if we're talking about discounts you're offering to a DTC customer or to a distributor or to a retailer directly, these discounts come off the gross sales. Sometimes people don't put them there. They say, no, this is sales discounts or distributor discounts. So they try to put them into that operating expense section. But then they forget, what is the concept of net sales? If you have gross sales and net sales, what's in the middle to go from gross to net? You have gross sales minus your deductions and your promotions to give you your net sales. And net sales is actually the metric that investors are looking at when they value your company as a multiple of revenue, for example. They're never going to value your company as a multiple of gross. What if you're giving 50% off your product to the entire world and selling a ton because of that, and your sales are super high, but what are your net sales after you gave all these discounts? So a reasonably discounted brand will get a reasonable net sales, not too low, and that's the foundation for valuation. But a heavily discounted brand does not deserve to be valued high because it just got a lot of volume through fluff and heavily discounting. So the one that you're talking about might be a little different. They're the Stripe's fees or fees from transactions, because they're part of doing business. In other words, you wouldn't get a DTC customer to pay for their order without that fee. That's the argument to say that it's part of your COGS because there's no sale without that fee. Okay. But accounting has gray areas, and we've seen it accepted sometimes to put Amazon fees or Shopify fees or credit card fees into a fee section in the operating expense. But it's not fooling anyone. Investors or founders shouldn't be fooled by the fact that their margin is truly, the margin should include these things, because these things are not going to change. They're per transaction. They're part of doing the sale. So cost of goods sold, that's part of it. Same as shipping a DTC item. You'd be like, oh, that's shipping, that's freight. I want to put that into a logistics and warehousing operating expense. You can, but if it's a DTC order, if you don't ship it, you don't sell it. So the shipping has to be part of your COGS.
Yeah. And I guess it scales with the sales, right? So another hint, maybe not always true, but it's a hint. It should be a COGS expense.
That's right.
How about for inventory? You mentioned that you only get paid maybe 6 months after the time in some cases, but you might need to buy your inventory or inputs, I guess, 3 months or, I don't know, a month before. So
of course,
you've stretched it even first. So how do you handle that? You know, when do you recognize that expense? Where does the inventory live, and how do you know when to bring it in onto your COGS or into your income statement?
Yeah. So the example of 6 months is the most drastic example you can hear. And it's only when you are a brand new client with a big distributor, they want to wait for you to have reorders and they're not going to just pay you. And the reason they don't pay you right away is because of those deductions, and they want to wait and see all the deductions that could have come before they give you the final check. Right. So that's why they give a 6-month period, and then they wait to see the cycle of orders coming in, deductions coming out before they cut a check. But in general, thankfully, once you're in business, they should pay you in 30 days or less. And so that's what you have to manage, about a 30-day cash flow. But before that, you're right, you need to produce. And depending on your relationship or the type of product you make, you can have a co-packer or co-manufacturing partner, or you can self-manufacture. Or in the co-packer world, you can have what we call a turnkey, meaning they just sell you the product and you pay them a fee and that's all included. Or you buy the ingredients, you buy the packaging, and they just charge you the tolling, the actual labor and the machines. But you control all the sourcing and therefore can negotiate at your scale with the vendors. Sometimes this is advantageous, sometimes it's not. Sometimes the co-packer is so large, you want them to buy your almonds for your granola bar because they buy millions of tons of almonds. You would never get the same price. So all of these things matter because it depends how much cash you need to put up front. If you source everything and you want to control, well, you're going to have to buy more packaging, more almonds, more sugar, more this, and then you're stuck with it. And then when you do a production run, you take a little bit of it. And so you have just more money in inventory, basically. You have the finished goods, great. And then you have the rest. So when you're a small brand, you probably don't want to get into manufacturing, and you want to try to find a co-packer that can do a turnkey product. And that way, the only thing you have to bear is that lead time and then the payment terms with the distributor. Usually we're talking 30 to 60 days in the back in terms of lead time. You pay half up front, half on delivery, and then 30 days after you sell. But obviously you don't sell everything. It's not like in an ideal world, a customer says, I want 100,000 units. Great, I'll produce 100,000 units, and then they'll go straight in your truck. That exists, but that is the ideal scenario. Produce to order is great, but then you have no inventory. So there's always cash stuck in inventory, cash up front for some of the production, and then waiting for cash minimum of 30 days to get paid. For all these reasons, you need always more money than in other businesses like SaaS or tech, where it's a little different. Lastly, you asked a question about the
balance sheet. Where does the inventory live?
Where does it go?
Yeah.
So typical issue is that when you've asked your uncle to do your books because he would do them for free at the first 2 years of the existence of your startup, they might recognize the purchase the month that you purchased. And it's very common to see the month of July where you ordered 100,000 units at $2 and it says 200,000 of COGS. Well, obviously, these are not COGS. These should go in inventory. And so just there's already a first step between a standard accountant and a CPG accountant that obviously will know to code this into the right place in the balance sheet and only move it, literally move the units into the month that you're selling them. Otherwise, your P&L is completely out of whack. You can't really the first errors that happen. And then after that, it can get more complicated because if you don't have a turnkey product, you need to make sure your balance sheet has the bottles, the labels, a few almonds, a bit of sugar, a bit of finished good, a bit of this. And then when you produce, you need to pick in each line the right amount to make the product, then put it in finished goods, and then cycle through it when you sell. So very easy for me to talk about it, not so easy for all the accountants to know, you know, how to do it.
Well, practically speaking then, I mean, we haven't even gone through half of all the ways. I've got a list here in front of me that we worked out here. And if there were 50 people listening to this thinking about getting into CPG at the start, I think we're down to about 3 people left because it already sounds like a nightmare of a business to me. So, but then how do you go about, let's say, you buy whatever, 100 kilos of apples, and you use 20 kilos. Do you do an allocation? How do you keep track of that even? Do you need a special inventory system? How do you keep track of what goes into a finished product?
Of course, it's all going to be done on spreadsheets at the beginning because you usually can't afford a software. And so these are some of the things that we help clients with, which is to make sure you have the right tech stack for the right time. And by tech stack, I mean Excel at the beginning. And at some point, you just can't monitor everything on spreadsheets. And when you turn a revenue of $2-3 million, maybe you can start professionalizing and adding an inventory system. that connects to your accounting system, and then you monitor this there. And then when you're over 20 million, you usually upgrade from even the accounting system that you started with to an ERP system. And right. So there are just steps and costs associated with those steps. But the old Excel works well if somebody knows how to follow this diligently with months and color codes. And operations people do this very well. Controllers do this very well in our space. So yes, you're asking great questions about all the problems. We're only talking about the problems, but obviously the CPG entrepreneurs are creating incredible products, solving food issues, especially in the US. There's so many things to fix. And then when they do it well, the size of the market means that the size of the prize is gigantic. And then you see Siete, a family-owned business held by brothers and sisters for the last 10, 15 years, sold to Pepsi for $1.5 billion, started from zero. There are many stories like these.
Okay, awesome. Well, I'll tell you what, I'm going to do a rapid fire and just a couple of other, I don't want to put everyone else off as well. I'm an entrepreneur. They should definitely go and do this. But just to hammer home why you need a fractional CFO, I'm going to give a rapid fire of a couple of things you have to watch out for. And I want you to give me your one liner on what it is. So okay. A slotting fee. What's a slotting fee?
Slotting fee is what you have to often pay to get into a retailer. They want either money or free product. If they want money, it's going to be per flavor. So if you have three flavors, they might ask you for $5,000 per flavor or sometimes $10,000 per flavor. If you have three, you need to give them $30K. And you just need someone that has finance acumen to calculate how long you're going to make the $30K. How long does it take to make it back? And if you're selling something that doesn't move much on the supermarket, like canned beans, it's going to take you forever to make $30K back. But if you're selling a beverage, going to take you, if you do well, it's not going to take you too long. So you might be open to it. And the free fills is the other word for slotting that is not dollars and is giving a case of free product. That is way less expensive because you literally deliver product. And once it sells, they start buying at the right price. So always go for free fills, always limit to one case per flavor. And in the best case scenario, no slotting, no free fills. But unfortunately, that's not how it works in a lot of supermarkets here.
Very good. Okay, we have one time for one last one, because this is an interesting one, for me anyway. Off invoices, what does that mean?
An off invoice or OI, a discount, like we were talking about deductions, discounts that you offer to the distributor, and in turn, they offer it to all the supermarkets they go to, but it's off the invoice. So if you get an order for $100,000, you just give a blank discount of 20% on that, and the distributor now is going to tell everyone, hey, this brand is 20% off. Do you want to buy it? If they buy it, great. But if they don't buy for $100,000 of that, the distributor keeps the money. So it's just a discount. Hopefully everybody takes it. But if you don't sell that volume, the distributor just made 20% off, and then they sell it at the full price because the OIs have a period. They have a limited time. It's like for a month or 2 months. So that's one of the tricks for them to make more money.
I'm fascinated. We have a long list here. We could keep going. We could keep going for hours. There's so many ways. I don't think I've fully realized how essential a finance expert is in getting into one of these things. I thought it was all Instagram and influencers and party nights and promotions. So maybe we could just wrap it up. Tell us a little bit. I mean, you touched on the success that is possible. Who's your ideal customer that you just love working with and you would like to reach out to, having heard this, and how can they do it?
Yeah, so thank you for that. For this, so at step two, we do bookkeeping, so the controller level and staff accountant level, and then CFO, all fraction of the cost of having a full-time hire and with the expertise of the food and beverage industry. Our ideal clients, we want to work with them relatively early, and we want them to grow with us until they literally fire us when they need to hire full-time. Getting fired is the graduation for us, and this can take 2 or 3 years if they're on an incredibly fast trajectory, or it can take 6, 7, 8 years when they grow slower. So we like to start when brands are $1 million, $2 million in revenue so that we can already provide some CFO support. But on the accounting side, we can start pre-revenue because there's everything to create. And then the largest clients we have are in the $20 to $30 million range. We don't have many because, like I said, when you make so much revenue, you also attract a lot of investors and you have enough money to pay for full-time staff. So an ideal journey for us is having a brand come in when they're very early and see them grow over the years with us supporting until we pass the torch to full-time staff.
Awesome. I have to say, I've rarely learned so much on a podcast. This has been fascinating. I really have enjoyed it. Thank you very much, Vincent. You can find you at Step 2 Advisors. And thank you for listening. If you've come this far into the podcast, congratulations. I don't like to send you away without having something. So what I've got for you is you can go to procurementexpress.com/newsletter and sign up for our newsletter. Now, I know what you're thinking, Vincent. Why would I want another newsletter in my inbox? Well, when you're dealing with other people's money, things can get hairy. It's very easy to trip up. Sometimes you can trip up and look embarrassed at the board. Sometimes you can trip up and end up in a newspaper. And sometimes you can even end up in jail. And every week, we take some of the worst and best examples of each of those and we put them in our newsletter. Why do we do it? Well, frankly, it's quite entertaining to see how people have messed up so badly. But also, you get a chance to learn from their mistakes so you can avoid the same problems and pitfalls they came across. So if you're in finance, I recommend you sign up for the newsletter. We'll keep you up to date with the latest ways people can mess up with their finances so you don't become one of those people. Also, we have now, we're running a number of specialized mastermind networking groups for industry-specific finance teams. So we're doing one for fractional CFOs, for grant managers. We're doing one in biotech and also in education. So if you're interested in meeting some of your peers at one of these events, it's also in the newsletter. And then finally, you can also keep up to date with upcoming podcasts, meet professionals just like Vincent did today, and you can keep up to date with trends in your industry. So, and that's it. procurementexpress.com/newsletter. Please join up on the newsletter. I know it's not your ordinary newsletter. I'm very proud of the work that we put into it, and I can guarantee you'll get some value. Thanks very much. And thank you, Vincent. This has been a good one.
Thank you for having me. Really enjoyed it.